This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history, and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the History of Persia. I'm Trevor Cully, and this is episode 162, The Great Revolt. In the last few weeks, we covered the general history of Greek philosophy, the loose outline of Seleucid philosophy and how it leaned heavily toward the Epicurean school at the Seleucid court, the history of Greek medicine, and how the Seleucids and Ptolemies both patronized physicians. Then there was the holiday special about the festival of Sade, and we did a speed run through some of the empire's most prominent neighbors, Antigonid Macedon, Ptolemaic Egypt, and Mauryan India, especially the Cleomenian War between Sparta and Macedon, and the gradual collapse of Mauryan power. That means our last stop in the narrative was episode 158, when we covered the remaining members of the Seleucid royal family, the deaths of both Seleucus II and his eldest son, Seleucus III, Kerenos. Callinicus died ignobly after falling from his horse, bringing an end to his chaotic tenure on the Seleucid throne. He came to power after his own father's sudden death, and almost immediately lost a huge swath of his empire to Ptolemy Euergetes in the Third Syrian War. Not only did Callinicus reclaim Mesopotamia and northern Syria from the invaders when Ptolemy withdrew, but Callinicus pressed the advantage. Only then, his brother Antiochus Hyrax tried to usurp the throne and carve off his own kingdom in Anatolia. Callinicus tried and failed to defeat Hyrax. Then Hyrax tried and failed to defeat Attalus I of Pergamon, who rapidly expanded his powerful city-state to encompass most of the region. When Callinicus died, his son became Seleucus Kerenos, and attempted to follow through on his father's plans to recapture Anatolia. But after the advanced forces were defeated in battle by Attalus, Kerenos was assassinated by his officers. The remaining Seleucid forces north of the Taurus Mountains tried to proclaim Achaeus, probably a royal cousin, their new king. But Achaeus refused, insisting that Kerenos's younger brother Antiochus was the rightful heir to the throne. So back in Antioch, King Antiochus III assumed the royal diadem. Antiochus was between 15 and 20 years old when he came to power. Exact dating depends on the source, but 18 seems quite likely. As a result, he was old enough to reign under his own power by Hellenistic standards, but quite young and very inexperienced. There was also the recent history of young kings named Antiochus attempting to take power for themselves when their elder brothers named Seleucus went off to war. So Kerenos had left one of his friends and chief ministers in charge, a Carian nobleman by the name Hermaeus. For all it mattered, Hermaeus was arguably the most powerful man in the empire at this moment. Antiochus himself was away in Babylon, the traditional seat of the crown prince, while the king was at war. Hermaeus was already in Antioch, laying the groundwork for a hasty coronation and ensuring his own primacy at court. As a sort of Seleucid prime minister, Hermaeus had already gained a reputation for ruthlessness in internecine disputes, apparently arranging assassinations and false charges on his rivals, or, at the very least, spreading around enough threats that people thought he would violently defend his position. Hermaeus' own family was based not in Antioch, but in nearby Apamea on the Orontes, giving him a firm grip on politics in the entire Seleucus district, especially within the middle nobility of the capital. Of course, he was not wholly unchallenged in the new king's inner circle. Antiochus himself was young, but still old enough to advocate for his own desires. Achaeus was away in Anatolia with the army, but that was a powerful position. Achaeus had a claim to the throne if anything would happen to Antiochus, the loyalty of the army, and he was not all that far away. He could threaten Hermaeus directly. Epigenes, fresh off a defeat in the war with Pergamon, had come back with a portion of the army to consult with the new king and advocate on behalf of the Seleucid military. There was also Diognetos, perhaps not as influential as the other three leading nobles, but tasked with the all-important job of chief diplomat when Antiochus came to power. And a diplomat was needed in that moment for a single, crucial reason. The main branch of the Seleucid royal family was on its very last leg. Neither Seleucus III nor Antiochus III had heirs. Seleucus does not seem to have been married, and Antiochus definitely was not, partly because the Seleucids suddenly found themselves running a deficit on eligible princesses. Faced with collapsing Seleucid power in Anatolia and the Aegean, and the dismal results of his own marriage, Demetrius II of Macedon had not continued the tradition of marriage alliances between Antigonid and Seleucid heirs. Instead, he sent his daughter Apama, herself a Seleucid, to marry Prusias of Bithynia. With Ptolemy backing Attalus and Pergamon, and the Seleucids forced out of the region, Prusias was the best candidate. Bithynia was also fighting Pergamon, and Macedon was also fighting Ptolemy. It seems like there may not have been all that many unmarried royal women left in the region, and basically none from the kingdoms that had positive relationships with Antioch. Diognetos finally found his new king a bride in the form of yet another Laodike, a daughter of Mithridates II of Pontus, making her Queen Laodike III. In all likelihood, she had initially been considered as a potential bride for Seleucus Kerenos. Polybius even suggests that she was betrothed to the Seleucid king for an extended period of time, and Antiochus did not have an extended period of time before becoming king. The royal couple was married in either the city of Zeugma or Seleucia on the Zeugma, which is the name of a river, depending on how you interpret Polybius. The former would seemingly place the ceremony on neutral ground in the Armenian territory of Comagene, while the latter would be on the Seleucid side of the Euphrates River. Regardless, it was much further from Pontus than would have been necessary just a few years earlier, before Attalus conquered most of Anatolia. Despite the unexpectedness of the succession, it all seemed to be going smoothly in Syria, until they received word from the eastern provinces, announcing that Molon, the satrap of Media, and his brother, Alexander, the satrap of Persis, refused to pledge support for Antiochus III and were withholding their tax revenues. Molon was also the general in command of the remaining upper satrapies, at this point mostly meaning the southwestern half of modern Iran. So with Molon's declaration, all of the upper satrapies were effectively in open rebellion. When Antiochus convened his advisors to discuss this revolt, Epigenes advised that the king should personally join the army and march east at once to force Molon and Alexander to submit. He insisted that it would be essential for Antiochus to be seen personally dealing with an outbreak of rebellion. Epigenes even raised the possibility that Molon wouldn't actually fight against them if the king was present on the battlefield, or failing that, that the rest of the eastern nobility would turn against their satraps and hand the rebels over to Antiochus for judgment. According to the ancient historian Polybius, Hermaeus flew into a rage at this suggestion, accusing Epigenes of plotting against the kingdom and trying to lead the young Antiochus into a trap by carrying him off surrounded by an army loyal to Epigenes rather than the crown. When Epigenes offered that he didn't have to be the commander, Hermaeus could take control of the army in his stead, which was a job that high-ranking nobles were expected to do regardless of their specialty. Hermaeus excused himself on the basis that he lacked experience. That was almost certainly true, but a point of embarrassment for the prime minister, made in an open council setting in front of the new king. It was a bad look. Instead, Hermaeus overruled the rest of the council and appointed a pair of generals called Xenon and Theodotus to command the army going east to fight Molon, while simultaneously insisting that Antiochus himself take command of an army marching south to invade Syria, the remaining Ptolemaic territory in Asia. Ptolemy III was known to be sick. His sons were quarreling with one another behind the scenes, and the Egyptians had been relatively hands-off in the region since the end of the last war. To Hermaeus, this seemed like an easy opportunity for Antiochus to gain some royal legitimacy and to strengthen his own position by offering an easy win and securing the borders nearest to his own seat of power. Then, a letter supposedly arrived in Antioch, supposedly sent by Achaeus, and supposedly claiming that Ptolemy was encouraging Achaeus to seize the throne for himself and offering support for a coup. Of course, in this letter, Achaeus made it clear that he had no intention of accepting such an offer, only that he needed to warn Antiochus of the problem. Polybius presents this letter as a forgery drafted by Hermaeus to warmonger against Egypt. But with the benefit of hindsight, I don't think that's true. If the letter existed at all, it would have been the real deal. And we will get into my reason for thinking that towards the end of this episode. The modern scholar John D. Granger offers an interesting interpretation of these debates around Molon's rebellion. He points to the fact that Molon did not take military action to begin this revolt, and to the ongoing power struggle between Hermaeus, Epigenes, and the other high-ranking ministers. To Granger, this suggests that Molon rebelled against Hermaeus as the ranking power in the kingdom rather than Antiochus himself. Granger also suggests that Epigenes spoke in favor of taking Antiochus to the east in order to get the king away from Hermaeus' influence and turn the tables, potentially hoping to convince Antiochus to see Molon's side of the debate and oust Hermaeus from power instead. But in the end, the sitting prime minister was just too influential. I think there is almost certainly some truth to Granger's idea. I don't know if I buy Epigenes and Molon were secretly collaborating just as Hermaeus accused, but the idea that Epigenes wanted to pull Antiochus away from Hermaeus' influence makes a lot of sense. It would also explain why Hermaeus was more than happy to participate in leading an army to the south, because he needed to keep up his own influence on the king. Shortly after the royal wedding and Laodike's coronation as queen, Antiochus III began preparing himself and his army for war with Egypt. Or more accurately, less than one-sixth of his army. Almost half of the Seleucid Empire, as it stood before Seleucus Callinicus, was now either conquered by Pergamon or in open rebellion. Achaeus still had an army in the field to the north, and another army had just left going east with Xenon and Theodotus. Antiochus only had access to a small fraction of his kingdom's hypothetical might for this war with Egypt. He barely had any navy to speak of at all, since Egypt and Pergamon now controlled almost the entire coastline from the Hellespont to the Sinai. The army that could be mustered would also be disjointed and poorly balanced, as the Iranian provinces routinely produced the bulk of the empire's cavalry, a disparity that would be shared by the army headed east. According to Polybius, Molon spent this time preparing for war too, but he did it by drilling his troops to prepare for battle as Macedonian-style phalangites and bribing the lesser satraps and local governors in Susiana, Drangiana, Aria, and Carmana to support him. As Xenon and Theodotus approached with their army in 221 BCE, Molon led his forces out of the Zagros Mountains, both to intercept the loyalists and to occupy more territory, seizing control of a region that Polybius identifies as Apollonia. It is not clear what region that is supposed to be, based on Molon's route and Strabo's geography. We get the impression that it was a temporary identity for the eastern part of Assyria around the city of Arbela, which is modern Erbil. In antiquity, this was more often called Sidakene. Either way, he crossed the Zagros Mountains into the western plains and intercepted this oncoming army. Polybius simply says that Theodotus and Xenon retreated in the face of a larger and better organized host. He also says that Molon's army celebrated as if they had won an actual victory, and Xenon is never mentioned again. Maybe there was a battle, maybe there wasn't, but in practical terms, Theodotus and his troops escaped, and Molon not only gained Apollonia, but advanced toward Seleucia on the Tigris. He was only halted by the fact that a loyal commander called Zeuxis had pulled all of the riverboats for miles in every direction to the western bank of the river to prevent Molon's army from crossing. When news of this defeat reached Antioch, Antiochus's first instinct was to redirect his efforts away from this hypothetical invasion of Coel Syria and go east in person, as Epigenes had first suggested. But Hermaeus overruled it again, designating another commander named Zenoitus to take charge of the next attempt to fight Molon. Zenoitus arrived at Seleucia on the Tigris and quickly made contact with the governors of Susiana and Carmana, who came over to the loyalist side with their armies and a train of deserters from Molon's personal forces. This boosted Zenoitus's confidence, and he advanced across the Tigris, encamping in a patch of dry land surrounded by pools and marshes with his best and most veteran soldiers. Molon's initial attempt to provoke a battle or ambush was a disaster. The rebel troops got lost and stuck in the marshland, injuring themselves and even some drowning in the attempt to navigate rough terrain. Recognizing the error of assaulting this heavily fortified camp, Molon took a different approach. He beat a hasty retreat, abandoning his baggage train on the eastern bank of the Tigris and racing back toward Media as fast as his army could go. Zenoitus's army seized the abandoned camp and partied to celebrate all of the great loot they had just acquired, back out in the plains on Molon's side of the river. Of course, Molon had not actually fled the field. His troops stopped a few miles to the north, ate their suppers, and turned back around to go to their camp, which was now full of drunken and sleeping enemies. The rebels fell on the camp in a violent melee, killing most of Zenoitus' soldiers in their sleep. Zenoitus himself tried to rally a gallant final charge into enemy ranks, and was killed, while still other loyalist soldiers tried to swim to safety and drowned in the middle of the river, some even taking their pack animals down with them. It was an unmitigated disaster for the Seleucid side, and their remaining forces evacuated the region. Zeuxis assumed command of what little remained of the army, alongside Pythiades, now the former satrap of Carmana, and they went north as Molon's army crossed the river and occupied Seleucia. Then Molon and Diogenes, the satrap of Susa, both turned around and went east. Molon swept along the Persian Gulf coast to establish control over Carmana and Gedrosia, before turning his sights on Susa. Diogenes barricaded himself in the citadel of the city and settled in for a siege when Molon's forces arrived to try and take Susiana by force. When Susa proved to be too well supplied and defended, Molon abandoned his assault and just went back to Seleucia to establish control over Babylon, establishing himself as the ruler of Mesopotamia as far west as a little city called Europus, on the western bank of the Euphrates. This was a town initially established as a fortress by Seleucus Nicator, and named in honor of his own birthplace, a Macedonian town called Europus. The local Aramaic speakers simply called the new Europus the Fortress, or Dura in their own language. For archaeological convenience, we usually call it Dura Europus today. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. March is the month of International Women's Day, a moment to celebrate women's strength and progress while also recognizing how much they carry with them every day. So this month, BetterHelp is taking a moment to celebrate women and all that they carry, whether that's in their careers, their relationships, their families, and the many other roles in their day-to-day lives. My wife just finished her PhD. It's this monumental accomplishment in her life, and we are excited to move on to next steps. But the process of getting a PhD and the process of entering a highly specialized job market in 2026 is wildly stressful, and therapy has been able to play a huge role in helping with that. She's made progress on many things over the last few years, and it's helping both of us work through the transition into the next month. And that's really what this is all for. Take a second and think about all of the stress of your career, where you are in life, or where you're going. All of that pressure builds up, and therapy can help create a balance, set healthy boundaries, and support overall well-being for everyone. BetterHelp does the initial matching work for you so you can focus on your therapy goals instead of scrolling through search results to try and find a therapist. A short questionnaire helps identify your needs and preferences, and their 12-plus years of experience means they typically get a good match the first time. If you aren't happy with that match, switch it up to a different therapist at any time from their tailored recommendations. Your emotional well-being matters. Find support and feel lighter in therapy. Sign up and get 10% off at BetterHelp.com. That's Better, H-E-L-P.com. I want to step back for a moment here and address another city in this occupied region, though. Babylon itself. First, a brief aside to mention something interesting that happened in the city shortly after Antiochus III became king. The Esagila, Babylon's greatest temple, was robbed. Gold, silver, and precious stones were looted from the temple treasury in 222. The culprits were caught relatively quickly and sentenced for their crimes according to one judicial chronicle from that summer. It's an interesting anecdote and likely points to an ongoing climate of unrest in the city as the Seleucid Empire became more and more unstable. That is just one element of the bigger picture here. I think, by and large, people today understand how small towns eventually die out. The smaller a town is, the less there is to hold residents and attract new people, until eventually so many people have moved away that there's just not a local economy. And the final residents simply have to leave or die off. This happens to small towns and villages all over the world all the time. It's just not a sudden thing. It takes years or decades or even centuries for the whole process to play out. It really only happens in rural areas. The closer you are to a city, the more likely that small town is to just be absorbed and built up into a suburb. Often, by the end, it barely seems like a town at all. There's just a few people living far from the nearest place of note. What is harder to grapple with is the process by which great cities decline into small towns and eventually into abandonment. Of course, it would be much harder for the megalopolis today to suffer the same fate with the incredible size of our buildings and urban sprawl fueled by modern modes of transportation. That said, the Babylonians had the most incredible buildings and the broadest urban sprawl ever conceived at their own time. The Hellenistic period is also the period of Babylonian decline, when Babylon went from one of, if not the, greatest city in the world, to a second-rate settlement that appeared less and less frequently in recorded history. Of course, the city had suffered blows before, with multiple sacks by the Assyrians before the history of Persia even began, but the Hellenistic period saw more frequent unrest and conflict in and around Babylon than the city had seen in centuries. This is the most chaotic period of Babylonian history in something like 400 or 500 years. That's enough time for civilizations to rise and fall all on their own. We've mentioned several riots or skirmishes breaking out inside the city walls before, and Molon's occupation of Babylon would have seen yet another full-on military occupation of the city within the same generation that witnessed Ptolemy III's brief conquest and sack of Babylon. Those are just the recent examples. The beginning of the Hellenistic Age saw repeated clashes in the city as the Diadochoi fought to establish their kingdoms. Plus, these occupations and revolts are inevitably followed by an imperial counterattack. Repeated occupations put strain and fear on the population, and strain like that causes people to leave. Even if they only mean it to be temporary, look at any refugee population in history, and you can see that many people settle into a new place and never go back. On top of that, the foundation of Seleucia on the Tigris shifted the region's economic and cultural focus slowly but surely. Babylon was no longer the local residence of the king and his court. That meant that many of the nobles who would previously have concentrated themselves in Babylon shifted to Seleucia. With them, the various artisans and servants who would have previously been in Babylon to serve the nobility had to seek work in Seleucia, and from there, the merchants and the farmers who supported the artisans and the servants also had to focus on the new city. This didn't happen overnight. Especially early on, it wasn't clear at all if Seleucia would be a successful experiment. But as Seleucia grew, Babylon shrank. As the Hellenistic Wars raged in and around the city, people fled, and Babylon shrank. At this point, in the 3rd century BCE, Babylon was still a very important city to the region. But the decline had begun, and events like Molon's revolt accelerated the situation. And every successive version of that accelerated the situation until sometime around the 1st century CE, the city truly began to die. All of that said, Molon's rapid success in the east was not the only shift in the status quo after Antiochus III became king. No sooner had Hermaeus started trying to convince Antiochus to invade Coel Syria while old Ptolemy III was focused elsewhere than Ptolemy III Euergetes died. Euergetes' eldest son, naturally another Ptolemy, was just as young as Antiochus and just as much under the influence of his advisors. Unlike Antiochus, Ptolemy IV Philopator, Ptolemy of the Loving Father, had many living relatives. His most powerful aristocrats, with or without the new Ptolemy's permission, engineered a massive purge of Ptolemy's brother, mother, and other royals beside the young king and his new sister-wife, Arsinoe III. So by the time Antiochus III marched south with his portion of the army, Egypt was in a moment of crisis as Ptolemy and his advisors solidified power for themselves. This left the initial stage of Antiochus's advance wholly undefended as he marched through Syria and approached the Lebanon mountains. The first strike in a fourth Syrian war. The only thing that stopped Antiochus from besieging the cities of Phoenicia outright was an exceptionally well-guarded mountain pass and highly effective Greek commander in the Ptolemy's employ. While trying to circumvent Mount Lebanon, Antiochus's army was repeatedly repulsed by the Ptolemaic fortifications in the mountain pass. Around the same time as this defeat, word arrived that Molon had not only defeated another army, but had advanced to seize more territory by force. Faced with a crisis and not making progress in Syria, Antiochus finally overruled Hermaeus and ordered his troops to return to the Seleucus, rest up, and prepare to go east. Hermaeus continued to insist that this was a bad idea, arguing with Epigenes as Antiochus tried to get their advice. Even with Hermaeus making thinly veiled threats against his other counselors, the situation was apparently too dire for the others to back down this time, and Antiochus decided that he would face Molon in person. According to Polybius, Hermaeus promptly started acting like this was a great idea that he had always supported, because ass-kissing knows no century. Their march into the east got off to the sort of start we might expect for an army in this situation. Antiochus, his counselors, and the royal army were still at Apamea on the Orontes, barely back from the Syrian campaign, when another dispute between Hermaeus and Epigenes led Antiochus to dismiss the latter from his court altogether. Epigenes was gone. This was immediately followed by a portion of the army going on strike in protest of unpaid wages and their preferred general's dismissal. They settled for their back pay and most of them fell back into line, but only most. Polybius says that 6,000 troops from Kyrene, the area of northern Syria between the Seleucus and the Euphrates River, went home and rebelled. And one of the army's commanders had to be left behind with even more troops to subdue this revolt inside the capital district. Worried that Epigenes might try to sabotage him while he was away, Hermaeus moved against the old general as well. He accused Epigenes of conspiring with Molon, had the former general's home searched, and wouldn't you know, a letter from Molon was supposedly found inside. Hermaeus convinced the king to have Epigenes executed for treason. Antiochus, now short one of his finest generals, prepared the army at Antiochia, better known before and after the Seleucid period as Nisibis, or Nisibin, over the winter of 221, before heading east. However, before we can address Antiochus's trip to Media, I still need to talk about the third front in this mess of a war and backstabbing, because Achaeus was still in Anatolia with his portion of the Seleucid army. And as the rest of the kingdom got pulled in different directions, Achaeus went back on the offensive against Pergamon. Very little has survived to describe the war between Attalus and Achaeus between 223 and 220. But by the time Antiochus reached Babylonia, on his way to fight Molon, Achaeus was well on his way to reclaiming almost all of the Seleucid territory in Anatolia, and Attalus had retreated behind his antebellum borders. The exception to this restoration of territory in the northeast came where King Prusias of Bithynia had some minor successes fighting the Pergamenes himself, and had claimed a few formerly Seleucid cities while the empire was away. Not a major loss. But 3 years was a lot of time for Achaeus to consider what he would do once Anatolia was back in Seleucid hands. Specifically, his Seleucid hands. And in those 3 years, he watched Antiochus III completely fold to Hermaeus's demands to split off a third of the army and head to Syria, while a major revolt tore away most of their empire. And nobody at all came to help Achaeus in Anatolia. And this is why I doubt that the letter he sent earlier was a forgery. After defeating Attalus, Achaeus did get in touch with Ptolemy IV, and asked if the offer of gold and ships was still on the table. When Ptolemy said that it was, Achaeus's army set off from Sardis to the Phrygian city of Laodicea. And while they were based there, letters started going out, addressed to the leadership of various towns and cities across Anatolia and the Seleucids, signed by King Achaeus. The region of Kyrene, the land between the Seleucids and the river, was still in revolt while Antiochus was in the east, and Achaeus intended to join forces with the rebels, seize Antioch, and challenge his cousin for the throne. Luckily for Antiochus III, it never went quite that far, because I don't think he would have won that war. But only because Achaeus' soldiers mutinied in Lycia and refused to do it. They didn't refuse to support Achaeus as an independent monarch, only to march against Antioch. So instead, Achaeus came up with a new plan. He turned around, pillaged Pisidia, because that's just what you do in central Anatolia, and you need when you need some bribe money, and he set to work carving out his own Anatolian kingdom, separate from the Seleucid Empire. We will return next time to cover Antiochus III in the east, but for the moment, in early 220 BCE, the Seleucid Empire, if you can even call it that, was effectively just the northern third of modern Syria and Iraq. And even sections within that little kingdom were starting to rebel. It was not looking good for the young king as he set out from Nisibis in the spring. Until then...
If you want more information about this podcast, you can go to hopfulmedia.com. That's where you'll find things like my bibliography, episode imagery, and additional resources. If you want to hear more of my voice, you can listen to America Secret Wars, where I tell my friends and guests the story of forgotten and overlooked conflicts in American history. And if you want to support my projects, you can go to hopfulmedia.com.co to donate, buy merch, or subscribe to get access to ad-free listening and bonus content. If you don't want to spend money on me, that's absolutely fine. The best ways to support a project like this are to share on social media or leave reviews on your podcast app of choice. So review on Apple, rate on Spotify, and you can find me on Blue Sky at History of Persia and on Instagram at History of Persia Podcast. Until next time, thank you all so much for listening to The History of Persia.
Hey, History of Persia fans, Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East, the very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history, and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title, the Great, for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.